Before a court could award the Central America to Tommy, the court had to have jurisdiction over the wreck. Before the court could have jurisdiction over the wreck, Tommy had to bring an artifact from the Central America, an anchor or a bell, into the courtroom and have it represent the wreck. A federal marshal would then arrest the artifact, the court would assume jurisdiction over the entire wreck, and the court would award the Central America to Tommy. But there was a catch. The wreck had to lie within 3 miles of the beach. That was the physical boundary of the court's district. No one had ever tried to salvage a wreck so deep it lay beyond the 3 mile boundary. Tommy could bring a piece of the Central America into the courtroom, but no one knew what would happen next. After studying the problem for some time, Kelly and Loveland recommended filing the claim in the Eastern District of Virginia, which sat in Norfolk. Besides having case law that seemed to favor their claim, there was a historical connection too. Most of those who survived the wreck of the Central America had sailed into Norfolk. Kelly and Loveland then searched Martindale Hubbell, the state-by-state reference on lawyers. If they had created the perfect lawyer for what they needed as Norfolk counsel, Kelly and Loveland likely would never have thought to include everything that came in the package of Rick Roble, a short, wiry man with a straight nose and puckish grin. Roble was 34, an admiralty litigator. He had graduated first in his class at the University of Virginia, received a Fulbright Fellowship, and had clerked for the chief judge of the Eastern District of Virginia in Norfolk. At Harvard, Roble had won the Addison Brown Prize for a treatise on admiralty jurisdiction. In that treatise, written almost 10 years earlier, he had examined the need for federal courts to extend their admiralty jurisdiction beyond the 3 mile territorial limits and into international waters. Roble confirmed that the Eastern District of Virginia would be their best forum. The judges knew admiralty law well, and the decisions that had come out of the district generally supported what Columbus America was trying to do. They decided to file. There was greater advantage in having an early audience with the judge. To lessen the exposure of including their coordinates, they would file two sets, one general set for the public and one precise set under seal for the judge. Just before the navigator set to sea, Roble talked to Tommy. He knew the threat of competition had forced Tommy to go to his emergency plan, and that his vehicle was no more than a bunch of parts, still in boxes on the back deck of the navigator. But he reiterated that retrieving an artifact from the wreck site was so important that even if interlopers did appear at the site, and even if they did try to interfere, even if it is on the brink of crisis, said Roble, he still would not ask the court to assume jurisdiction over the wreck until Tommy had raised an artifact. Roble filed the complaint in the Eastern District of Virginia in Norfolk on May 26th. That night, down in Jacksonville, the NICOR navigator departed Atlantic Marine. 200 miles at sea aboard the NICOR navigator, early summer, 1987. Bill Burlingham stood 5'4", but he seemed 6'2". He had a 17-inch neck with matching forearms and chest. Only 33, yet a sea captain for 12 years, he also had bright blue eyes and a thick reddish-blonde mustache. Burlingham was another of the men from the deep ocean community who had worked with Williamson and Brockett on government projects. The navigator ran through the night at 10 knots. On the back deck sat the makings of an ROV they hoped could dive to a bottom deeper than any ROV had ever been and retrieve an artifact. The vehicle now was a drastically stripped-down version of a drastically stripped-down version of the vehicle parked inside Tommy's head. A simple sled with just video and close-in sonar. And Moore couldn't even run both at the same time. On the afternoon of June 12th, Scotty gave Burlingham the range and bearing for the first track line, and they deployed the vehicle. The control room was cool, air-conditioned for the computers, and dark except for digital readouts and the light blue glow of the Mesotech sonar screen. Nearly 9,000 feet below, the sled glided through the darkness with the Mesotech sonar sweeping ahead 100 meters out. Nearing midnight, Tommy and Barry were in the communications comm shack when they heard Scotty's voice on the intercom. They had seen the wreck, and up close on the Mesotech, it looked even more like a sidewheel steamer. Everyone watched the blue monitor as the sonar swept the darkness. Rocket noted in a sly voice how much this image resembled the C-Mark image from the previous year. He accused Moore of having created the Mesotech readout over the winter to match the C-Mark sonar images. He's been waiting for the right moment to put it on the screen. Good one, laughed Moore. It was now after midnight. Tomorrow they would find the wreck again with the Mesotech. The Seaward Explorer had been chartered to bring out more vehicle parts, pick up Don Hackman, and drop off two new deckhands. Tommy had needed two more tech crew members to handle deck lines and to help launch and recover the vehicle, and he couldn't advertise. They thought first of Brian Anderson, whom Barry had befriended at the University of Florida. Brian knew engines, and he had sailed on blue water. Todd Steele was a polite young man. His sister Paula had become the home office backbone of the Columbus American Discovery Group, responsible for the payroll, the bills, the insurance, and the partnership filings. Todd had just finished his sophomore year at Ohio State and was visiting his sister when Tommy called looking for a deckhand. Todd thought, who would turn down a chance to go out on a boat? Later, on the afternoon Todd and Brian arrived, Tommy wanted Kraft to launch the vehicle again, so they could get a camera down on Sidewheel. But problems with the crane kept the vehicle on deck until late that evening, and by then the weather had begun to fall apart. For the next 3 days, the wind topped 20 knots and the seas ran to 6 feet. By mid-morning on June 17th, the sea had dropped, and Kraft orchestrated a safe launch of the vehicle. As the cable reeled off the winch for a two-hour descent, they heard the drone of a single-engine plane. Their pilot had arrived with the first airdrop of the season, and everyone came out on the deck to watch him circle. The pilot's name was Steve Gross, and he was the vital artery between shore support and the ship. A supply boat often took 20 hours to get out to the site. Gross could make it in two. He was 65 and had been flying for 46 years. Tommy had bought Gross a 42-year-old single-engine seaplane. Gross had saved Tommy one day's operation, so in its first flight, the CB had paid for itself. When Moore turned on the vehicle's systems, the Mesotech sonar was not working. For the next 2 days, they ran 9 more track lines with the camera, and they found nothing. The morning of June 22nd, the video camera was working well, and even the Mesotech seemed to be functioning. Then late in the afternoon, they acquired a target on the Mesotech. Scotty alerted Tommy on the intercom, and he guided Burlingham closer and closer to the target. The monitors suddenly filled with varying shades of gray, and they saw the stern of the wreck on camera. Everyone stared at the monitor for 5 minutes before they again lost contact. But Scotty now had a good fix on the wreck. He told Burlingham to come around. After an hour, they saw the stern again, and Moore dove the camera sled just inside the starboard wall of the wreck. For the next 14 minutes, they followed the wreck in a slow sweep, from the stern all the way to the bow. A little farther on, they saw anchor chain trailing across the white floor into the darkness. No one spoke, but everyone wondered why the site looked so clean. Where was the decking, the stairways, the cabins? Biologists told Tommy that the site was so deep, the water so cold, and the pressure so great that no bugs could live down there. The ship, 40 feet high, 50 feet wide, 280 feet long, should be virtually intact. Maybe the scientists had been wrong. Where were the side wheels? The boilers, the masts? Where was the coal? The Central America sank with more than 200 tons of coal still in its hold, and coal wouldn't degrade. But they saw nothing. Nothing but the hollow shell of an old wooden vessel. With a passenger liner, you'd expect a lot of anything, said Tommy. Dishes, personal effects, you know, stuff. This was the first time anyone had ground-truthed the sonogram of a deep water wooden shipwreck. The first time anyone compared what they saw to what appeared in the sonogram. And what appeared in the sonogram of Sidewheel, what had impressed Williamson and his crew and Bob Evans and everyone else who had seen the sonar images of the wreck, wasn't there on the bottom. No one could explain the hump in the middle of the sonogram that had looked so distinctly like paddle wheels. Before they reached the bow, Tommy said, "Let's get out of here." With the possibility of competition appearing at any moment and the whole search map now to be reconsidered, they had no time to waste on a site with such low probability of being the Central America. Tommy had considered the possibility that Mike Williamson might be wrong in his analysis of the sonograms. Williamson was the best, but no one had ever seen a wooden shipwreck in deep water. After a tightly controlled effort to construct a probability map using the most sophisticated methods available, they had searched over 94% of that map and so had a 94% probability of having imaged the Central America. Even in Tommy's limit-your-risk world, that was an overwhelmingly high probability. The Central America had to be somewhere in their database. Tommy assigned Bob Evans and John Deering to review the major targets on the optical disc. First, they analyzed the images in black and white, comparing the features of each to what they had seen in the sidewheel images and what they had found at the sidewheel site. Then they went to the color mode and experimented with drawing more information from the images. Finally, they got to the sonogram labeled Galaxy. In 1986, the sonar team had imaged Galaxy only after Tommy insisted they stop running high-resolution passes over sidewheel. The debris field surrounding the core had intrigued Tommy. It swirled about the site like a galactical spray, so Tommy had named the site Galaxy. It was the last wreck site they had imaged in 1986. Bob and Deering now sat watching the software paint Galaxy in black and white. At the core appeared to be a primary deposit, indicating the hull of a ship. Then came a secondary ring of debris, and finally a tertiary plume of more debris. It looked like a ship that had twisted and turned on its way to the bottom, spilling its contents as it traveled down through the long column of water, the contents scattering in a swirl around it. Now that they had ground-truthed sidewheel, they knew more about interpreting sonar images, and they saw quickly that Galaxy appeared to have a lot of hard targets at the center and thousands of tiny bright reflections in the debris field, scatters of what they thought might be chunks of coal. Tommy estimated that the site had at least a 50% probability of being the Central America, and maybe a much higher chance than that. For 2 days after they made the camera run along sidewheel, Bob and Deering studied sonograms while the rest of the tech crew tested equipment. Tommy decided not to dive again until they had reconfigured the vehicle for better photo and recovery work. He wanted thrusters to position the vehicle, additional cameras to take color video and stills, and a manipulator to retrieve an artifact. For the next 5 days, the tech team worked and ate and slept once in a while. The weather now was nearly optimum. And then, just before midnight on June 30th, they saw a glow moving slowly along the horizon to the northeast. Burlingham estimated the other ship's speed at 1 to 2 knots. Cargo ships and tankers traveled through, running 10 to 15 knots. Tommy no longer had to guess whether or how or when the competition might arise. All that night and throughout the next day, the ship moved slowly, sometimes erratically. So Tommy knew they were at the beginning of their search, still coordinating the boat crew and the tech crew and adjusting to whimsical currents. He found it suspicious that they had begun their search within a few miles of the sidewheel coordinate Roble had filed with the court. The second morning, Tommy realized that if the vessel continued on course, the sonar fish behind it could pass close enough on the first track line to image the wreck at Galaxy. He told Burlingham to point the bow of the navigator on an intercept course with the other boat. The navigator closed quickly. Kraft watched her through binoculars. "It's the Liberty Star," he said. "She's out of Cape Canaveral." Once they got within a mile or two of the other vessel, Burlingham could do nothing to force or even encourage the captain to alter his course. Burlingham was even uncomfortable with his bow aimed at another vessel still 8 miles away. Tommy had learned from the lawyers that the law was unclear on what happened if another salver attempted to salvage the same wreck. If the other salver interfered in a certain way, the court might split the salvage award between them. "The idea was to make sure they didn't get to that point," said Tommy. Tommy wanted to know the Liberty Star's speed, its bearing, the length of its track lines, and how long it took to turn and begin again. He needed to understand its search area so he could predict where it might go. Tommy surmised that the track lines of the Liberty Star would run 25 to 35 miles, which meant that on each track, she would drop over the horizon and not be seen again for a day to a day and a half. If he knew exactly where they were, he could calculate how much time he had to get onto Galaxy, launch the vehicle, find out as much as he could, recover the vehicle, and get back over the horizon before the Liberty Star returned. On July 2nd, the Liberty Star hit the south end of its track line, turned and headed north. The following day, Tommy instructed Gross to fly out, Plot the position and bearing of the Liberty Star, then shoot a roll of film with a telephoto lens and drop it near the navigator. When Deering developed Gross's pictures, they confirmed what Kraft thought he had seen through binoculars 2 days earlier. Something shrouded in a tarp sat on the back deck, and it appeared to be big enough to be a deep water ROV. For 3 days now, they had charted the movements of the Liberty Star. Meanwhile, the vehicle had grown from a helpless creature that could barely see and hear into a deep ocean exploration system with 5 cameras for eyes, a sonar for ears, an 80-pound telemetry unit to talk, 70-pound thrusters to walk, a 60-pound manipulator to pluck, a 30-pound brain to command, hundreds of pounds of batteries for a heart, and hundreds of feet of hydraulic hoses and electrical cables, the arteries and nerves, to connect it all. But when they tested it on deck, circuit breakers blew, signals scrambled inside the cable, and the manipulator hung like a useless appendage. By the night of July 3rd, it was still not ready to go to the bottom. Yet sometime the next day, the Liberty Star would be on top of Galaxy, and the only hope Tommy had of stopping them was to be on the site. By 2 o'clock on the morning of the 4th, they launched the new vehicle. "We had no choice," said Tommy. A little past 3:30, the vehicle reached bottom. On the monitors, they saw the white sediment of the ocean floor. A half hour later, they began searching for the wreck site. While the vehicle probed at 8,000 feet below, Tommy, Barry, and Bob huddled with Kraft and Burlingham on the bridge. In a few hours, the Liberty Star would appear. Robel had advised Tommy that the law of salvage required a salver claiming the wreck to stay on top of that wreck. Tommy could rest his crew and repair his equipment, but he could not leave the site or he risked losing control. On the bridge that morning, Tommy told Burlingham that if the Liberty Star tried to enter the waters above Galaxy, he had to stand fast and, if necessary, drive her off. But Burlingham refused. Burlingham had his own law, the Sea Captain's International Rules of the Road, and if another ship towing equipment needed to pass over the site, the rules forbid him to squat motionless on top of it with nothing in the water. When the vehicle below lost power, they had to recover it, and the moment it hit the deck of the navigator became the burden vessel, and the Liberty Star became the privilege vessel. Then Burlingham had to give way. If that vehicle was not legitimately in the water at the end of a long cable, Burlingham would allow the Liberty Star to run right over the Galaxy site. Robel got on the phone with Burlingham to explain the legal ramifications, but Burlingham did not trust lawyers who were back on shore when he was 200 miles at sea in command of a ship and responsible for the lives of 20 men and another captain he couldn't predict. The rules were clear. If you, the captain of the giveaway vessel, encountered another vessel restricted in its ability to maneuver, you gave way. Or you, the captain, lost your license, maybe paid a fine, maybe went to jail. Not the lawyers, you, the captain. With the confrontation unfolding at sea, Tommy's first thought was, don't alienate the captain of your own ship. But Tommy pushed. If they try to come through, can we say we're preparing to put equipment in the water? Or I think we're going to have it in the water in 15 minutes. He suggested that maybe within the rules were maneuvers Burlingham could perform if he thought about them ahead of time. Like a game of chess, said Tommy. That idea intrigued Burlingham. He wouldn't cheat and he wouldn't lie, but he would try to outwit. In specific situations, he had some leeway under the rules to move and countermove his ship so that he was properly positioned to be the privileged vessel. Tommy went back to the comm shack and called Robel. He wanted a few words from Robel to convey in the strongest language possible their legal claim to the site, however uncertain that might be. Robel replied, "You can say you've entered an action." Tommy liked the sound of that. It was true, yet the words might stump someone else. "Okay, we'll use those words, entered an action." And he wrote down the phrase for Burlingham to repeat on the radio. But Robel was not finished. "And tell them you are rescuing a vessel in marine peril." The words came right out of the law books. When a salver discovered a wreck or tried to recover it, it was called rescuing a vessel in marine peril or distress. And it didn't matter if the wreck was sinking or sunk or had been sunk for a long time. The salver was rescuing valuable property from the ravages of the sea and returning it to the stream of commerce. Burlingham hailed the other captain on the radio. "I would just like to advise you of something," said Burlingham. "You may possibly want to copy it down." He began reading slowly. We have entered a court action in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia. We are currently in the process of rescuing a vessel in distress. We advise you that any action you take which would endanger or interfere with our rescue operations could result in your being found in contempt of court. I am concerned for the safety of your vessel and ours. Burlingham repeated the statement twice until the other captain said, "Good copy." They signed off, but within minutes the captain of the Liberty Star was back on the radio, asking for the entity on board the Nicor Navigator, the date the action was entered, the name of the vessel in distress, and the period of rescue. "I guess I have a personal concern as a fellow mariner," the captain continued. "If a vessel is in distress, I would think the Coast Guard would be desirous of having that information passed along to us to assist you in your search efforts."
"Over?"
Burlingham caught the sarcasm. The captain was probably smiling at those gathered on his bridge as he said it. "Roger," said Burlingham. "The term distress is a legal term with precedence behind it. We'll get back to you with those answers shortly." When Burlingham called back a few minutes later, he identified the entity as Columbus America Deep Search Incorporated. They had filed on the 26th of May, 1987. The vessel in distress was an unidentified, wrecked, and abandoned sailing vessel. Initial salvage is underway. This portion of the salvage operation is partially dedicated to formulating a total and comprehensive salvage plan. Dates and times will be filed with the court as the salvage proceeds. Then Burlingham said, "We're just wondering what entity is on board your vessel." "Stand by," said the captain. And when he came back, he said, "Our response to your last, the trustees of Columbia University." At 8:15 on the morning of July 5th, they launched for the second time at the Galaxy site. The lights and cameras worked and the mesotech was operating again, but the manipulator joints were too stiff to reach out and grasp. A little after 5 in the afternoon, they saw what they had been looking for, what Tommy knew was missing from the wreck site at Sidewheel, piles of coal. They ended the dive at 6:30 in the evening, and the vehicle had just begun its ascent when the Liberty Star appeared on radar 16 and a half miles out. Tommy told Kraft to get the vehicle on deck as quickly as possible, put the batteries on the charger just long enough to get them up for another dive, then be ready to send the vehicle back down. With the Liberty Star steaming toward them, Moore stood topside, trying to adjust the joints on the manipulator. Each had to be oiled and finely tuned. It usually took several trial-and-error dives to figure it all out, but Moore didn't have several dives. He had one. As a backup, Brian and Todd mounted what everyone called the crab trap, a 3-foot-wide metal screen that would hang from the bottom of the vehicle. If Moore couldn't get the manipulator to work, he would try to scoop something in the trap. Until they brought up an artifact from that site 8,000 feet below, they had little more legal claim to the Galaxy wreck than did the treasure hunters aboard the Liberty Star. 6 hours after Deering had pulled the vehicle from the water with the crane, he lifted the vehicle off the deck and lowered it back into the water. When they saw the huge debris field at Galaxy on the second dive, they had chosen the artifact to present to the court, a lump of coal. "Coal is the perfect first artifact," thought Bob. "It's fuel to the ship. It was only $20 a ton or so, but nonetheless it had a defined value, and it's an object undeniably from a wreck." With a catch-as-catch-can scoop and an unpredictable manipulator sporting 10,000-pound crushing strength, Bob did not want the first retrieval attempt to be focused on a teacup. For the next 2 hours, they continued running the monotonous track line, seeing nothing more on the cameras. And then suddenly, looming in front of the vehicle was a pile of coal. Moore waited until the pile was only a few feet away, then he dove the vehicle as fast and as hard as he could. The monitors exploded with sediment roiling through the water, and Moore blindly tried to snap the manipulator jaws closed. "We weren't sure if we got it or not," said Bob, but Moore really plowed into that thing. It was now almost 10 o'clock in the morning. No one had been to bed the night before, and all 4 men in the control room were exhausted from staring at the monitors for the last 6 hours. Moore could see that the manipulator jaws were open and empty again, but he thought they might have snagged a lump or two in the crab trap. Bob radioed Tommy in the comm shack that they were ready to recover, but Tommy said to bring the vehicle up only a safe distance from the bottom, then leave it deployed over the side. The Liberty Star had stopped in its southeast track line, where she now dawdled. Tommy didn't know what she would do next, but he wanted the vehicle in the water to give Burlingham an advantage under the rules. At 2 p.m, the Liberty Star began to turn. As the captain executes his turn, thought Tommy, that'll give Kraft just enough time to get the vehicle on deck. With the Liberty Star in the middle of its turn, Kraft ordered Todd and Brian out on the hero boards with knives and marlin spikes ready to transfer the weight of the vehicle from the cable to the crane. Then he pointed his index finger upward and ran it in tight circles, signaling to Deering to take in the line. Deering raised the boom, and the vehicle rose from the sea in a rush of water. The manipulator arm still stuck out, the jaws frozen open with nothing in them. As the vehicle reached eye levels, they could see the crab trap underneath, and that, too, was empty. No one was surprised, but everyone had hoped. The Liberty Star had completed its turn and was pointed south. Deering was swinging the vehicle over the rail when a sparkle caught Deering's eye. Before he set the vehicle down on deck, he yelled, "Get that!" Wedged into a corner of the vehicle's lower frame was something shiny and black. As the vehicle met the deck, one of the techs reached into the frame and pulled out a chunk of anthracite coal almost 6 inches across. How a piece of rock wedged in an aluminum frame could make it all the way to the surface without falling out with the vibrations and the air-sea interface, I don't know, said Deering, but it did. By mid-afternoon, Liberty Star had circumnavigated the navigator. Now she turned back to the southeast along her original bearing and disappeared off radar late that night. No one could explain how the lump of coal made it all the way to the surface, but no one cared. They had an artifact from the wreck site, and now they had to get that artifact to the courthouse. But the courthouse was in Norfolk, 300 miles away, and the Liberty Star circled the shipwreck site like a shark. They couldn't leave. A supply boat would take 2 days to pick up the lump and deliver it to Norfolk, but Tommy had another idea for Gross. With the sat phone fading in and out, Tommy explained his plan to Gross back in Wilmington. The idea was simple. All Gross had to do was risk his life in a maneuver that inside territorial waters was strictly forbidden by the FAA. Because seaplanes were built to land only in calm water, Gross could not land in the sea. So Tommy would have the artifact hanging off the stern of the ship on breakable line, and Gross would align the CB on a run parallel with the stern, ease his altitude down to a few feet off the water, drop his speed to just above stall, fly within a few feet of the ship, snag the artifact with a grappling hook trailing 100 feet behind the plane, then goose the engine before he augured in. It was just the sort of low-tech engineering solution Tommy loved. After the barnstorming pickup, Gross landed in the Cape Fear River, the bundle bouncing along the surface until he had stopped the CB. He opened the door, reached out with a boat hook, snagged the nylon loop, retrieved the package, tossed it in the back seat, and took off for Wilmington to gas the plane. Then he left immediately for Norfolk, where Roble met him at the airport. Roble immediately returned to the courthouse to the U.S. Marshal's office. The marshal was amused. He said to Roble, "This is the first time I ever arrested a lump of coal." That afternoon, the judge reviewed all the papers. For now, he assumed jurisdiction over the matter and awarded Columbus America full salvage rights to the shipwreck site. At 2 o'clock the next morning, the Liberty Star reappeared on the navigator's radar screen. Tommy knew that the court had awarded him the wreck, but he had no proof of it because the SATCOM phone was down and he could not receive a fax of the orders. Burlingham hailed the captain and requested him to stay clear of their work area. Later that afternoon, Roble was finally able to fax the orders to the ship, and Burlingham read the statement, quoting portions of the arrest warrant and the judge's order designating Columbus America substitute custodian of the wreck. The captain acknowledged a good copy of the message and said nothing more. The following morning, July 9th, the Liberty Star captain radioed Burlingham and read the following statement. As of 9:32 Eastern Daylight Time today, we are not in receipt or notification of any order or injunction issued by any court of competent jurisdiction that precludes us from surveying the open waters of the Atlantic Ocean. Obviously, the party on board the Liberty Star had talked with their own lawyer. Accordingly, continued the captain, we hereby advise you that we have started a survey transit line, which will pass through the area specified by you, and we request that you do not interfere with our passage along this survey line. Roble had wanted an injunction ordering others to stay away from the site, but judges will not issue an injunction unless someone's life or property is in imminent peril. This was the imminent intrusion Roble had been waiting for. Tommy told Kraft to launch the vehicle immediately. Then he telephoned Roble, and Roble helped them draft an affidavit for the judge. Barry signed it and faxed it to Judge Richard B. Kellum at the courthouse in Norfolk. By 1:30, Judge Kellum had granted a temporary restraining order for 10 days. Roble now filed a motion to show cause why the Liberty Star and her personnel should not be held in contempt of court for having interfered with Columbus America's ongoing salvage. He also asked for an injunction against the Liberty Star, and because the captain had described the entity on board his ship as the trustees of Columbia University, Roble served each trustee. "That stirred things up a bit," said Tommy. "They were all subpoenaed to court." The hearing was set for July 15th. The day after they got the restraining order, Kraft launched the vehicle again. For the first time, the thrusters operated so they could land. And Moore had the manipulator tuned well enough to reach out stiffly and pluck artifacts from the debris fields. At 9,000 feet, they shot video and dozens of stereo stills, and Moore retrieved fragments of wood, several more lumps of coal, and a sampling of mud. While the techs explored the debris, Tommy and Barry prepared for their trip into Norfolk. Tommy had to testify in court, and the navigator could not leave the site. The only captain they could find to come out and pick them up was a teenage boy, willing to make the 400-mile round trip in his father's fishing boat with two of his buddies. The boat smelled like dead fish. It was dirty, and Tommy suspected that lice hid in the beds. He and Barry tried to sleep, but in the confused seas, the pounding of the hull did not stop for 22 hours. The next evening, Tommy and Barry went to a small airfield south of Wilmington, where a little single-engine plane flew them to Norfolk in a rainstorm. When they arrived at the courthouse, they saw sitting in the corridor not the trustees of Columbia University, but Tommy's real competitor, a renowned treasure hunter named Bert Weber, wearing his trademark safari jacket and a huge silver and gold diver's watch. Weber had gained fame and some fortune in 1978 when he beat John Deering and Seabourn Ventures to the wreck site of the NS Concepcion on Silver Shoals off the Dominican Republic. Roble presented the judge with several sets of stereo slides of the wreck, which Tommy looked at through a handheld viewer and narrated for the judge. Next, Tommy narrated videotape of John Moore's recovery of a lump of coal. Even in the poor quality of the footage, everyone could see something growing out of the top of the coal, a delicate sponge-like creature. On the desk in front of Tommy sat a large, wide-mouthed bottle filled with cold seawater. In the bottle was a chunk of coal, and attached to the coal was the same wispy white creature, floating upward like a tiny hourglass. Judge Kellum adjourned the hearing at 5 o'clock, instructing the lawyers to be back in court the following morning at 8:45 for closing arguments. When the lawyers and Tommy and Barry arrived in court for the second day of the hearing, noticeably absent from the corridor outside was Bert Weber. Judge Kellum gave each side 30 minutes for closing argument, then retired to his chambers. When he returned, he issued his opinion from the bench. "Though the items are small," said Kellum, "it would seem that all that is required is that it be identified as part of a particular wreckage, and thus it has been done. And if the court has jurisdiction of the wreckage and of the plaintiff," continued Kellum, "I would think that it has jurisdiction to protect that wreckage, to see that it is not destroyed." As he spoke about the need to protect the site, he noted, "The area marked off is small in comparison to the amount of area of the Atlantic Ocean, some 12 square miles. There isn't any question in the minds of anyone that the plaintiffs have located some sunken ship. Whether it's the SS Central America or not, I doubt if any of us know. They may have a good idea that it is, but the injunction in this case certainly should not, and does not, run to the vessel SS Central America until it is clearly established that the vessel in question is that vessel. Once Columbus America recovered items of value, Judge Kellum would decide who owned them. In the meantime, the judge enjoined anyone in the world that knows of it from interfering with Columbus America's salvage operation at the wreck site." As Judge Kellum spoke from the bench, the Liberty Star was already over halfway between Norfolk and the wreck site. They sent the Liberty Star back out there while the judge is in court comparing final arguments, said Loveland. They figured we'll get out there while these guys are still in court. Bert Weber still wanted a peek inside that little box. But Tommy had already considered this scenario, and that's why he had spent 22 hours on a tossing fish boat. When the Liberty Star cleared the radar horizon that afternoon, the navigator sat there like a hen on a golden egg, and even the court now warned not to ruffle her feathers. After Judge Kellum rendered his decision, the Columbus America Discovery Group issued a statement in the form of a news article. It was headlined, "Shipwreck Discovery Opens New Era of Deep Ocean Exploration." With the find released, Tommy and Barry holed up in a motel, where the phone calls cost less than the $10 a minute on the sat phone at sea. "We were hammering the phone," said Tommy, "calling as many people as we could about different things, engineers, partners, scientists, to make as many connections as we could." At Tommy's direction, the tech crew was to film and photograph the wreck. Tommy did not want the site disturbed. All he wanted were thousands of photographs and thousands of feet of video. The morning of August 8th, Tommy and Barry returned to the navigator. Tommy seemed refreshed and ready to spend another 2 months at sea. But Kraft took Tommy aside and suggested that a crew rest would be desirable. Tommy agreed not only to head in, but even proposed flying the crew's families to Charleston and putting them up in a nice hotel.